Hello and welcome to I Am Geek. This is episode 146. I'm Ryan. I'm joined by my brother Chris and our good pal Katrin. And we are live on YouTube and we have a very, very special guest with us. A legend, if you don't mind me saying that. A legend with us today. Now, you guys know Tyler Dean McDowell. He's on all the time. He's one of our favorite guests. But tonight, or today, we have his dad on, Ronnie McDowell, the country legend, over 30 top 10 records, right? Would that be correct? Yes?
I don't have a
clue. Ronnie, how are you doing today?
I am doing unbelievably well, and like Dave Ramsey said, a lot better than I deserve. And that's the truth. But I'm doing great. It's good to be with you boys, seriously.
Well, thank you for being on here. We're going to, you know, dive into your life a little bit and then just dive into what you geek out about, which I've heard is the king himself, Elvis. So we're going to dive into that. We're going to have some fun today. And you just feel free to just talk all you want. Tell as many stories as you like. We're here to listen.
But as a matter of fact, part of what I do, I go over the country and this guy that booked me in 1980, Danny Raspberry. He now hires me. He does financial planning stuff, and he hires me to go to these kind of like little convention things, and I just get up and tell them about my life. And so I'm really excited about being with you, like I said, because I'm the world's biggest Elvis geek. And that's the truth. I've been Elvis's voice in, let's see, I think 12 movies, wow. The ABC series. Wow. I started out with my friend Dick Clark.
Oh, wow.
American Bandstand. Cool. Yeah, I was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I had a hit record out called The King Is Gone, which me and a friend of mine, Lee Morgan, wrote about Elvis Presley. I was driving down the road August 16th in my Camaro, my 77 Camaro that me and the bank owned. You know how that goes. I just got through rehearsing with my band. We were playing in Bowling Green, Kentucky. And ironically, the last song that we rehearsed, I told the boys, I said, you know, you got to remember in 77, Elvis was still having top 40 records. He had a song out called Way Down. And then he had can't even think of the name of the song. And I sang it all the time. But anyway, I told the boys, I said, I know Elvis has these two songs out, but I want to learn an old Elvis song. So we did Return to Sender, and we rehearsed it to do it that night. I got in my car, and I can take you to the exact spot right now. Turn the radio on. Now, the reason I know this is because my number is 222. I see it all the time. Well, that afternoon, that little voice on my shoulder said, look at the radio. And when I did, it was 2:22 in the afternoon, and the DJ goes, it's official, Elvis Presley has passed away.
Oh, wow.
I turned it to another station. I didn't believe it.
Yeah.
I thought, yeah, right. And so I turned it to another station, another, and every gospel, sports radio, everybody was talking about Elvis's demise. So I finally thought, well, it's probably true. Now, I was a songwriter at the time. I'd written songs for a lot of people before that. But if you don't mind, I'd like to go back to 1968 in Portland, Tennessee. I graduated. Mm-hmm. Barely, but I graduated.
Congratulations.
I think they just let me out.
But anyway,
but I joined the service, and I thought if I joined, the Vietnam War was in. Hey, that's what was going on. So I thought if I joined, I wouldn't have to go to Vietnam. Wrong. out of boot camp, San Diego, big old manila envelope, and it said Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
So I landed in Saigon October the 26th, 1968, barely 18. And I was there in 68 and 69. So I went to personnel after 2 years, and I said, and those boys was my age. You know, we were all like 18, 19, 20. So I told the boys in personnel, I said, hey, I've been here 2 years. I want out of here. And they looked at my records and they said, yes, you have. We will get you out of here in 2 weeks. True story. So 2 weeks later, I got on this plane, took off, went home for 30 days, and I landed in Adak, Alaska. I like to froze myself to death. For 13 months, I was in Adak, Alaska. And so after getting out of Adak, Alaska, I get back to San Francisco, big old manila envelope, and it said Vietnam. Went back the third time. Wow. They didn't treat me too good, but the war was going on, you know. And I am so proud of my service. I'm a three-term combat veteran. But while I was in Vietnam, I had a band. Had a band in Adak, Alaska.
Huh.
And so I started writing songs when I got out of the service in May of 72. First person I ever wrote a song for was Johnny Cash. I'll do a little of it for you.
Oh, wow.
Now, the reason, because I'm the world's biggest Johnny Cash fan. I'm a Johnny Cash geek. Nice. Hank Williams Sr. is my total country icon. I have a lot of them, but Hank Sr. doesn't get any better. So anyway, I walked into the house of Cash, and I said, "Sir, I've written you a song, but I'd like to sing it like you." And he said, "You don't have it on a tape?" And I said, "Well, those little reel-to-reels back then were about like that." I said, "I got it on this little reel-to-reel, but I've got my guitar out in the car. I'd like to sing it for you, because when I was growing up, you influenced me a lot." And he goes, "Well, son, let's hear it." So in my best Johnny Cash voice, I went, "Well, I believe in good old rock and roll, and I believe that music is the soul of country, blues, and pop. I could never knock hard rock, 'cause all in all, it's rhythm from the heart, from the cowboy who is reaching for the stars in some godforsaken bar looking for a start, from the long hair and his sound getting high from getting down. Yeah, all in all, it's rhythm from the heart." And so he said, "You have been studying me, haven't you, son?"
That's incredible. Yeah. That sounds just like
awesome. Oh, well, thank you.
That's great.
So after that, thank y'all, I was driving down the road and I had written this song called Deep in the Heart of Dixie. So I'm going to a club on Lebanon Road in Nashville to do my gig. Had the Grand Ole Opry on, and Roy Drusky, you probably don't know that name, but he was a huge country star at the time. He had just come off of a Kris Kristofferson song, number one record, called "Look a Yonder, There Comes Jody and the Kid." So I'm driving down the road, and all of a sudden, this piano riff comes on, and I went, "Now, I've heard that somewhere." Well, lo and behold, Roy Drusky started singing my song on the Grand Ole Opry. I didn't even know that he had recorded it. I jumped, I pulled over on the side of the road, ran around the car with my arms up. Wow! One of the biggest thrills still to this day. So I did a duet with Dolly Parton not long ago, which is on my new album.
Oh, nice.
And I'm so excited about it. And Dolly, I was telling her that story, and she goes, "Ronnie, you ain't going to believe this." I said, "What, Dolly?" She said, "Well," she said, "the same thing happened to me." She said, "I was driving down the road in Nashville, and all of a sudden, I heard Whitney Houston singing 'I Will Always Love You.'" She said, "I didn't even know that she recorded." She said, "I pulled over on the side of the road and did the same thing you did. I ran around the car three or four times." And so I knew the feeling. And I'm so excited about the duet that she and I did. And ironically, the song is called "Last Night I Dreamed About Elvis."
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Nice.
So anyway, let me go to 1977 again. So 15 miles down the road. I know this is hard to believe, but this is the God's truth. That song did not pour out of my heart. It came from my soul, because in 1958, I'm sitting in a movie by myself. Now think about that. My daddy let me go see King Creole by myself. I mean, I cannot imagine of an 8-year-old going to a movie by himself. But I was a very independent little cuss. And for 50 cents in 1958, I got to see King Creole. I got popcorn and a Coke. And when Elvis came on, he was 30 feet tall in black and white. And I was like, wow. And I've never been the same.
Now, is it true that you told your dad that you were going to that King Creole was a monster movie?
Oh yeah, I lied to him. He didn't like Elvis because he thought that was the devil's music. He was from, you know, he was born in 1910, went through the Depression, and you know, he didn't. The last thing he wanted to see was a hip swiveling 19-year-old, you know, singing rock and roll. But it was the coolest stuff on the planet because my sister Linda Sue. But we call her Tootie because she loved Little Richard's Tootie Fruity. And so she brought home all of these wonderful records, the black records, Fats Domino, Little Richard, the Platters, Johnny Cash, Lefty Frizzell, Hank. She was bringing home all these wonderful records from Randy's Record Shop, the world's largest, where you could, they sent out more records from Randy's in Gallatin, Tennessee. It was world famous, owned by, let's see, what was his name? Randy Wood. And of course he's gone now, but he lived to be 90 something. He also found Pat Boone and a lot of other artists. But anyway, so, all of those songs influenced me like you would not believe. And then one day my sister brought home this record, Don't Be Cruel and Hound Dog. I kept playing Hound Dog over and over until my mother come in there. Well, she worked three jobs to take care of us. There were 11 of us. Wow. I don't know how she did it. My mom and dad divorced in 55, right? But I was only five, so I didn't, you know, I spent time with daddy and mother. I didn't know anything about divorce. And so anyway, my mother, she came in there and she said, you are not going to listen to that song one more time. So she turned the record player off and then she went to work. And I sat back down and I turned that record over and it was Don't Be Cruel. And I'm telling you, when I heard Don't Be Cruel and Elvis slapping the back of that guitar, well, you know, I can't be found. You know, I was like, what is this? I didn't know that was him slapping on the back of that guitar, singing at the same time. Wow. I now know. But anyway, that affected me so much. And then I, like I say, I went to see King Creole and I got to see this guy. And I was like, you know, that guy is too pretty to be a guy. That's what my little 8-year-old brain was thinking. You know? But anyway, now think about this, boys. What if somebody had tapped me on my little 8-year-old shoulder while I was sitting in that theater? I think about this all the time and said, what if somebody would have said, you see that guy up there? You're going to be his voice one day in movies. And you see Scotty Moore up there, the guitar player? You're going to work with him for 40 years. Wow. You see the drummer, DJ Fontana? You're going to work with him for 40 years. Do you see those Jordanaires up there? They're going to be on all of your records. They're going to be on your first number one record. And how would I have wrapped my mind around
yeah, for real.
Wow. So when that record, The King Is Gone, hit, what happened? I flew to Memphis the next day. I'd never laid eyes on Elvis, right? So I was bound and determined to see Elvis Presley. I got up at 5 o'clock, flew to Memphis in my Camaro. I stood in line. You would have had to have been there, boys. The media played this down. There were hundreds of thousands of people there. I felt like I was in the military again because they put us five abreast. And at 8:30 in the morning, I got in line. At 5 o'clock, I still to this day, I don't know how my bladder held up. I stood in line from 8:30 till 5 o'clock and I got 10 feet from the gate and they closed.
Oh,
I didn't get it. And people started rioting. And I got to thinking, I don't want no part of this. Now, Steve Jeppy, my friend Steve Jeppy, up in Baltimore, who owns the Baltimore Orioles as well. Uh-huh. He and I have become really good friends. He's like my brother now. But he's the number two Elvis fan in the whole wide world. When I first met him, he said, it's God, it's my family, and then it's Elvis Presley. And I said, Steve, you're preaching to the choir. But I get it. So anyway, Steve told me, and I told him the story. I got back in my Camaro, flew to Nashville, right? Halfway back to Nashville, had the radio on, and this DJ goes, well, they've opened the gates back up. I was like devastated. So I get to Scorpion Records office. It was getting dark. And there was a young fellow standing there, Lee Morgan. He said, "Ronnie, I want to do a tribute to Elvis Presley." And I said, "Lee, I am not wearing a jumpsuit." He said, "That's not what I'm talking about." He said, "Listen to this song I wrote." So I listened to it and I said, "Well, man, listen to what I wrote the other day when I heard that Elvis had passed away." So when you hear that record, I was barely 6 years old when I first heard him sing. And remember what I told you, sitting there playing that record. And I knew from that moment on, it'd be a lifetime thing. And I'd stand in front of a mirror day and night, and I repeated every word and every note till I almost got it right. I didn't get it. Nobody gets it right. There's only one Elvis. But anyway, I learned every nuance, every syllable. I even learned how Elvis would breathe between a syllable. Mm. But by doing that, little did I know, years later, when that record, "The King Is Gone," broke that Friday afternoon in Nashville, I literally took it to a little AM station. I had 8 acetates made. And here's the irony of that song. When I recorded that song that night at Music City Recorders, little did I know, you know whose studio that was? Scotty Moore's, Elvis's guitar.
Wow.
I didn't know that. So the next morning, I'm sitting on the steps of Monument Studio because I knew that I could get a big old acetate made for $8. But the night that we recorded it, we had no earthly idea how to do this, what to do, or anything. Sorry about hitting the mic. But anyway, so we did it, and Lee came up to me, and he said, "You need to sing this song like Elvis would do it. You need to talk like Elvis." And I said, "Lee, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to be." I said, "I'm Ronnie McDowell. I'm a songwriter." He said, "If you do it, it'll affect people more." Well, so I did. And had I not done that, I don't think it would have worked. But by doing that, everybody thought I was an Elvis impersonator. But anyway, but that's okay, because I was Elvis's biggest fan. Nothing wrong with that, because I'm not that. You know, no jumpsuit and sideburns and all that, jet black hair. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so Lee Morgan walked up to me at the studio and he said, "You're going to have to pay for this. I don't have a dime." I said, "Lee, I've got $42 to my name. How much is it?" And he said, $2,800. Do you know how much money that was in 1977?
Yeah.
My heart froze. He said, "Well, you're going to have to pay for it." He walked out the door. Literally, he just walked out the door. And I'm like, I had the musicians, the studio, the engineer. I wrote $2,800 worth of hot checks to pay for that song. I slept with that tape that night. It was about that thick. It was in a little box about like that. So, but I didn't sleep hardly at all. I woke up again at 5:00 and I flew down to Nashville. And for 2 hours, I sat on the steps of Monument Records, Monument Studio. And here come this lady that I knew, Gail. Well, once again, here's the irony and the twist. I did not know that Gail was Scotty Moore's girlfriend. Now, where is the irony in all of this? And so she goes, "Ronnie, what are you doing here this early?" And I said, "Gail, I think I got a hit." She goes, "Well, what is it?" And I told her. She said, "Well, come on upstairs. We'll make you an acetate. I want 8 acetates." She said, "Why 8? And I said, "I don't know. I just want 8.
It's a good number.
So, yeah, so they were put it on the machine. The needle started going around to make the first one. This guy walked by. He goes, "Who is that?" And I said, "That's me." He said, "Well, I'm Lee Shannon, the program director up in Indianapolis. If you will give me one of those, I'll take it back and play it and see if you get any reaction." Well, I give him one. I didn't know Lee Shannon. I learned later who he was. And so I left there after, by the way, I wrote hot checks for those too. So I went to a little AM station called Weno Radio in Madison, Tennessee, 1 mile from Colonel Tom Parker's house.
Wow.
Walked in and I said, "Would y'all play this?" And this girl goes, "Well, we don't do that just off the street." I said, "Well, it's about Elvis." And remember, 3 days later, Elvis died, right? So the Elvis emotion was through the roof. She said, well, hold on a minute. So she took one of those acetates back to the DJ behind the glass, and he took his finger and he said, come here. He listened to a little of it and he said, you stand right here. I'm going to play this, see if you get any reaction. 1/4 into that acetate, all of his phone lines lit up, and he said, something's wrong with my phones. He said, man, you ain't going to believe this, but these people are wanting to hear this, and it ain't even over. 3 hours I stayed there, and it never, the phone stayed wow. lit the whole time. So I left there, and I went to the number one pop station in Nashville. I mean, I was feeling, well, you can imagine. And so I walked up. I went up the elevator to WLAC, the number one rock station in Nashville. And I told the girl the same thing. I said, hey, any chance I get you? We don't do that. We're the number one station in Nashville. And I said, well, let me tell you what happened. So I told her the story. She said, well, hold on a minute. So she took one of the acetates and she walked back, and there were three guys standing in the hallway, and they looked at it. And he looked at it, and the other guy, and he walked into this little room. And then he come back out. I could tell 3 minutes later that he listened to it, and he said, come here. He said, you stand right here. I'm going to see if you get any reaction. I said, you going to play it? And he said, yep. I want you to know, he come out 3 minutes later. He goes, son, you have jammed our phone lines. You got a monster. And it exploded. Wow. It exploded wow. so much that they wanted me on the Grand Ole Opry the next night.
Wow.
So I'm standing, tapping the wall, scared out of my wits not to sing in front of an audience. I didn't know the song. We just threw it together. And I'm standing, tapping the wall, and Jim Ed Brown, unbelievable singer, songwriter, he walked up to me, and he was a regular on the opera. And he said, son, you're going to do fine. I said, Mr. Brown, I ain't afraid to sing. I just wrote this song, and I don't know it that well. He said, when did you write it, son? And I said, 3 days ago. And he said, 3 days ago? Well, good luck, son. I want you to know, I walked out, and the place, the Grand Ole Opry, was, they were hanging from the rafters. I never missed a note. I never missed a syllable. Wow. So I had to leave right soon. I had to walk out the door and had to fly to Chattanooga. They wanted me on at this place, this club, at 10 o'clock. I barely made it when I pulled up. This guy walked up and he goes, Ronnie, the record company has sent me here to take care of you. I said, what's all these TV trucks doing here and stuff? He said, for you. I said, you're kidding. He goes, son, you don't have a clue what's going on, do you? And I said, not really. I said, everything's just kind of going crazy. I said, my head is spinning. He said, well, we have given 20 girls $20 a piece to scream when you come on. I said, what? He said, well, it's the old Colonel Tom Parker thing. You give them 20 bucks, first 20, and the rest of them will start screaming. When I walked on, the whole place rushed the stage. I went and got behind my drummer, and he goes, get away from me. They'll kill me. And so it was pandemonium. I mean, it was crazy. Wow. So then I went to Peoria, Illinois, that got on a plane. They was throwing me on shows with everybody. This was the craziest thing. The Gatlin brothers were backstage at the mosque, and they were doing push-ups, had their shirts off, and I went, wow, is this what you do at a show? It was Larry Gatlin and George Jones and Tammy Wynette. And I was so thrilled. Not that I didn't like the Gatlin brothers. I loved them. Loved Tammy Wynette. But George Jones, one of my icons. I couldn't believe I was on a show with George Jones. Wow. And a promoter walked up, and he goes, Ronnie, it's good to have you here. Said, you got the hottest record in Peoria. Said, you sold all the tickets. Not that they didn't sell any, but you capped it off. He said, everybody's here to hear you sing that new song. So I said, well, I'm here to hear George Jones. Well, I did my thing. The Gatlin brothers did theirs. Tammy walks out and she goes, well, I hate to tell y'all this, but George ain't going to be here. He's drinking at a little bar around the corner. I was devastated. The next day, I get on a plane to go to Atlanta with Kenny Rogers. George is in the back of the plane. I walked back there and I said, "Hey, George, where was you at last night?" And he goes, "Sit down, son." And we bonded from that moment till he passed away.
Oh.
We were friends till then. So the what I'm leading up to is the next night I'm in Walker, Louisiana. And the guy come up to me and he said, "Hey, you've got a phone call." The guy says his name is Dick Clark. And I said, "Are you talking about the Dick Clark?" And he goes, "Well, that's who he says he is." So I went back there and Dick Clark goes, "Ronnie, this is Dick Clark. You go to the airport. There's a private jet for you. Get some rest. You're going to be on American Bandstand." I said, "Yeah, right. Who is this?" He said, "Ronnie, this is Dick Clark. Get on that plane." I said, "Okay." I didn't sleep a wink. I landed at the L.A. airport. There was a helicopter. I got on that. I landed right on the front lawn of ABC. They rushed me into the dressing room, and I'm getting makeup on, and here I'm looking in the mirror, and here comes Dick Clark. And I went, "Wow, Dick Clark, I can't believe I'm here." He said, "Ronnie, you've sold 1 million records in a week. You're number 9 on the pop charts. You deserve to be here." Wow. I said, "Well, Mr. Clark, I'm glad y'all pantomime, because I don't know this song that well." And he goes, "Ronnie, we don't do that anymore. You have to sing it live. When that red light comes on the camera, there'll be 80 million people watching you." And my heart froze. And I want you to know, when you can Google me on there, I look like I knew what I was doing. But inside, I was petrified. But I never missed, again, I never missed a syllable or a note. And then, you know, weeks after that, he called me up and said he was doing a movie about Elvis Presley. He said, "I want you to be Elvis's voice." And I did. I did 38 songs in that movie, and Kurt Russell was the star. He was incredible. I mean, I thought I was singing all the songs and he was mimicking me, but Kurt literally became Elvis Presley. And then after that, I did the movie with Priscilla Presley. And then, you know, Elvis and Me, I did 36 songs in that movie. And what the whole time all this was going on, I was having my country career. And if you listen to my records, it's just Ronnie McDowell. I ain't trying to be nobody but me, you know. Because I've always had the philosophy that we're all individuals, all of us, and we can only be who we are. We can't be Elvis or Jimi Hendrix or anybody but ourselves. But I was a songwriter at the time. I've written so many songs, and I'm still doing that. Mickey Gilley and I, Monday, are doing a new song on my new album. Crystal Gayle and I, we just finished a new song that I wrote, which is going to be on my new album. Wow. Me and Mo Bandy, a new song. So I'm writing songs for everybody and his uncle. George Strait makes me a lot of money, so thank you, George. So anyway, have I been blessed or what?
Ever since
I was a little kid watching that King Creole movie, which I lied to my dad and I told him later on, and he laughed about it, but he really became an Elvis fan in his later life. He really did. Loved Elvis's gospel music.
Wow.
So that was the beginning of my career and my life, so to speak, growing up in a house with five brothers and five sisters. Wow. And my mother trying to work 3 jobs, bless her heart. But now that first record, here's what I'm going to tell you, boys. The best thing and the reason that I am forever grateful to Elvis Presley, and nobody owes a debt of gratitude to Elvis like Ronnie McDowell. Let me tell you why. My mother was working at Pure Truck Stop that Friday afternoon that record broke. She was mopping the floor. I walked in. I said, "Mother, take your apron off. You never have to work again." She goes, "Son, can't you see I'm working?" I said, "No, Mother, you never have to work again." And this truck driver was sitting at the counter, and he goes, "Georgia May, don't you know what's going on with that boy?" She said, "No, what's going on?" I said, "Mother, come out to the car. This is the God's truth." I turned the radio on, and my song was on every station. Wow. Every country gospel. And that's the truth. And she never worked again till she died.
Wow.
So
that's awesome.
Isn't that a wonderful story? Yeah. That's the best part of that record, what it did for my mother. And that's God's truth. Because she was such a wonderful moral best little mother. Yep. So with that, there and then again, I'm the most blessed soul on the planet, and I truly am. Tyler and I, you know, we've been painting things for Disney, you know, and I told my daughter, she called me and said, Daddy, you need to do a Disney painting. And I said, Athena, they have the world's best artist. What in the world would, she said, Daddy, just do one. So Tyler said, hey, Dad, let's do Walt Disney getting on the California Limited in 1923. He didn't have a dime to his name. He had to borrow the suit he had on. I said, how in the world do you know all of this? He said, because Walt is my Elvis. Yeah. And I said, I get it. So we painted that. My daughter, we took high-resolution photos of it, sent it to Disney Fine Arts. They gave me a 5-year contract with that painting. Not just me and Tyler. So, again, when I was a kid, every Sunday night, there was only 3 channels. But every Sunday night, all of us kids would gather around TV. The world is a carousel of color. And that's what I would hear. Never in my wildest dreams would I be painting stuff for Walt Disney. So have I been blessed? So thank you, Jesus.
Yeah, it's great how, a passion for something just can skyrocket you if you just, let it happen, sort of. And you were just living your dream and your passion. And
I was.
God did great things with it.
Oh, the Lord. I mean, my friend Steve Jeppy, he said to me, he said, you know why you didn't get in that gate? I said, why? He said, if you would have got in that gate, do you know how long that driveway is up to Graceland? I said, well, yeah, I've been there many, many times. And he said, you would have never made it back to Nashville, and Lee Morgan would not have been standing in the Scorpion Records office. He said, fate is a hunter, Ronnie, and it found you, and you were not meant to see Elvis Presley. And I said, Steve, I'm going to use that the rest of my life. Fate is a hunter. He said, it will find you. And it found you. And I believe that. I did not want to do the song Older Women. I just thought, women do not want to be known as older women. That's not good for their ego. And Jamie O'Hara, who wrote that song, he had written a number 2 song for me, actually a number 1 for Cashbox, just before that. And me and Buddy Killen, my producer, were going to record. I already had all my songs. Here comes an arm and stopped the elevator, and it opened back up, and it's Jamie O'Hara. He said, Ronnie, you have got to record Older Women. I said, Jamie, what have I told you about that song? He said, Ronnie, you got to do it. I'm telling you. I said, Jamie, he said, Ronnie, I'm 30 years old. My girlfriend's 38, and I know what I'm talking about. Older women are better lovers. I said, Jamie, play it for me again. Unbelievable singer. He wrote a Grammy-winning song, which he gave me, and I turned it down, and we're cut off. I can't see y'all.
Oh, really?
Oh, we can still hear you.
Oh, you can hear me?
We can hear you and see.
Yeah, we can see you.
Okay. So I can't see y'all, but that's okay. I'll get Tyler to.
Yeah, Tyler can come in.
Yeah, Tyler, he's coming in. But anyway, where was I?
You got the song Older Women. You decided to do
oh,
it.
Oh, yeah. So Jamie O'Hara sat down and sang it for me with the guitar. And Jamie, by the way, I got to tell you, he had just given me a song called Grandpa Tell Me About the Good Old Days, which the judge did, and I turned it down. But boy, do I have a lot of stories about turning songs down. So anyway, he played it for me with a guitar, and I said, okay, Jamie, we'll do it. So we went down, and I had talked Buddy Killen, my producer, into letting me record like they did back in the 50s, where the Jordanaires gather around a microphone. And Buddy said, Ronnie, we just don't do that anymore. We isolate people in booths. I said, Buddy, please let me do it. So he did. And I swear to y'all, this is how fate works. So we did the song. I go inside the sound where Buddy was sitting there at the controls and everything, and Buddy jumped up out of his chair, and he goes, "What else do we need to do?" I said, "Buddy, I don't even know this song." He said, "Listen." I listened to it. Number one record, one take. So wow. Tell me again, fate will find you.
Yeah.
If it's meant to be, there are no coincidences, believe me.
That's true. You know, if I'm remembering correctly, Catron, you and I have a little Elvis connection.
How's that?
Yeah.
We were in a band in college, and we recorded at a studio in Bristol, Virginia. And the guy brought us in, and I don't remember his name. It's been so long ago, because I'm 42 now, or almost 42. That was a long time ago. He brought us in. He goes, "I want to show you guys something." And we said, "Okay." And, you know, we're just college students back then. He took us to the soundboard, and he goes, "Do you know whose soundboard this is?" And I said, "I don't know." And he goes, this soundboard belonged to Elvis Presley, and you're going to record on it today.
And, really?
Yeah, it was, you know, of course, you know, taken aback that, you know, we got to do that.
And, did they tell you where they got it?
Probably, but I don't
somebody
remember.
Owned it afterwards, and I'm trying to think of his name right now, but he talked about the little Pepsi can stain that was on the board. He's like, "That was somebody's." And it was really interesting. Like, all these people had recorded through it. So it was neat.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, we were in the digital age already, so there was no point in using this,
right?
Except that it's a really neat historical piece. That
And I'm a history fanatic, and I love stuff like that. I absolutely love history. And Tyler showing me. It said Ryan wants to talk to you about your trunks of Clark Gable.
not swimming trunks. So.
Yeah, no swimming trunks.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm the world's biggest Clark Gable geek. I'm as much a Clark Gable geek as I am almost Elvis. Not quite, but pretty much. And I'm such a Clark Gable geek. I've read every book about him, you know, and know everything about him, you know, and he passed away at only 59. And when he died, I thought he was an old dude, you know. And of course, my friend Conway Twitty, he died at 59, but I was only like 40, I think, when he passed away. And I thought Conway was old, but now I realize these guys were young at 59. And Clark Gable, you know, they called him the King of Hollywood. And you know who crowned Clark Gable the King of Hollywood? Ed Sullivan. Hmm. Yeah. And Myrna Loy was the queen. And Clark Gable never liked that. He told Spencer Tracy, he said, "You know, this king stuff's a bunch of baloey." He said, "There ain't no light in me. It makes me shine any brighter than anybody else." And he said a line, and I use it to this day. He goes, "You know, we're all just people." And isn't that the truth?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're all just people.
Yeah.
So I use that too. I use Steve's fate as a hunter. That's my favorite, because it is. It'll find you.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you, going back to your painting, how did that all start? Like, you know, you're in the music business. Was that from younger, or did that come along in later in life? Or how did the painting, because your paintings are beautiful.
Oh, well, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. And my hero is Norman Rockwell.
Uh-huh.
And I love Da Vinci, and I love Michelangelo. If you could see my foyer, I laid on my back on a scaffold. But I was a little smarter than Michelangelo, because I put a mattress up there so it'd be more comfortable. But I painted a Michelangelo scene on my foyer, and it took me 8 weeks. And the night that I finished it was, I had the radio on, and Obama had got elected, President Obama. And so I never will forget that moment. That the night that I signed it, but it took me 8 weeks to do that. And it's one of my favorite pieces in my foyer. So, you know, but getting back to when it started in 1956, my school teacher, Miss Paula Reddick, she said, "Ronnie, can you draw?" And I said, "Well, I think so. I've been drawing little rabbits and things at home." And she said, "Well, draw me something." So I drew her a big old red fire engine, and I colored it and all. And I went to see her before she passed away, and I said, Miss Reddick, you remember the first thing I ever drew, or I, in the first grade, I drew a big old red fire engine for you. And she goes, Ronnie, I kept that. I'm a pack rat. I said, Miss Reddick, I'd give my eye teeth to have that. She goes, nope. You're famous now, and I'm giving it to my kids.
That's awesome.
But that's, I would have given anything just to see it.
Yeah.
But she passed away long after that. So I got interested in art all through school and through junior high school. I did things for school teachers. And as a matter of fact, in the high school yearbook, there's a picture of me sitting there and with my basketball shoes and my football, because I played every sport. And I was voted most talented because mainly of my art ability. So that was wonderful. Wow. So that's, you know, I've been doing it ever since I heard Elvis, 56.
Wow. Yeah. And Tyler's picked it up too. He's
Oh Lord, Tyler, he's good. Gone through the roof with it. He's way beyond daddy, but I love that. I mean, his creativity, when I give him an idea and he puts the work compensation together and the draft, everyone he does, I'm like, you ought to see this one he just did for me. I guess, Tyler, I guess we could show it to you. This one, well, maybe we should.
We've seen some of them. I don't know if we can show them.
Yeah, but it is mind-boggling, and everyone he does is better than the last. And he goes, Dad, you say that about everyone. But I truly mean it. I'm just mind-boggled by his creativity. Yeah. But, you know, it's the right side of the brain. It's the arts and the entertainment. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he and Ronnie Dean, and I'm not so sure about my daughters. They couldn't sing their way out of a paper bag. But they have their own talents. You know, they're talented kids. I have a granddaughter. I have a couple of granddaughters that are into art, Sophia and Jovi, and they're the youngest ones, and they're into art. So hopefully some of that is passed on down.
Now they're wonderful.
Thank you.
All of your art and Tyler's. So you've played with legends and greats. And is there anybody today that you hear and you're like, man, I'd love to do a song with them? Maybe like a newer artist or somebody.
My favorite artist that's out there, has been out there for a while now, is Bruno Mars.
Oh, cool. Uh-huh.
I love Bruno Mars. I love his singing. I love his writing. To me, that boy is through the roof. Mm-hmm. His creativity is unbelievable. And plus, when he was 4 years old, I was at Graceland doing something with Priscilla Presley. And he was standing beside me in a little white jumpsuit, and he was 4 years old. He was the world's youngest Elvis impersonator.
Wow.
And that was his nickname, Little Elvis. But I mean, how did we know that was going to be Bruno Mars?
Yeah.
You know, at the time, you never know.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've been blessed on my new album. Speaking of that, I have 20 duets that I've done in the last 43 years. And I told you about Dolly. But my new single is me and the Righteous Brothers and Bo Duke, John Snyder.
Wow. Oh, cool.
And I took the old 1974 million seller Rock and Roll Heaven that the Righteous Brothers did. I rewrote the lyrics and it's now Country Heaven. And I played it for my friend Bill Medley, the bass singer. You know, I had the time of my, who doesn't know Bill Medley? You know?
Yeah.
And Bill, I said, Bill, would you sing on this with me? And he said, of course I will. And I said, well, you sang on it originally. And so when I sent him the demo, he called me back 3 minutes later and he goes, Ronnie McDowell, you have a hit. I said, well, I think so too, Bill. So when I got all these duets together, there's two with me and Jerry Lee Lewis. One of them I wrote. So I was 36. Jerry Lee was 52. He comes into the studio with a fifth of Jack Daniels. True story. And he sets it on top of the piano. He said, now, killer, now before we do your song, we're going to do this song. And we was all geared up to do Never Too Old to Rock and Roll, which we had a hit on. And I said, what are we doing, Jerry Lee? He said, son, never you mind. You just pay attention. And he strolls down the keys and he goes, heartache number one was when you left me. I never thought that I could hurt this way. And I want you to know we captured that. And it's me and him doing a duet on it. It is absolutely beautiful. Yeah. Not me, but him. And I wouldn't take anything for that. I mean, nothing. That was, it's just a jewel, but they're all jewels to me because on this new album, it's called Country Heaven, Roy Acuff, Farron Young, Dobie Gray, Little Jimmy Dickens, Eddie Arnold, and the list, there's like on this one song, One Big Family, that me, Troy Seals, and Mike Reed wrote. And I'd already written it, but they helped me do some things to clean it up and make it even better. Thank God. Because all of these unbelievable artists, a lot of them are gone now. So I sent it to Mike Curb. I haven't had a release in 30 years. It's been 30 years since Unchained Melody, 1990. Wow. So I sent this duet album to Mike Curb along with Country Heaven. And Mike Curb called me and talked to me for 3 hours. He said, Ronnie, I'm going to release this album. I said, Mike, I've been trying to get you to pay attention for 30 years. He said, well, you got my attention. Me and my wife, we love this whole album. He said, it is so historical. I said, Mike, you're preaching to the choir. And so he called me again. And then he called me again. And he is so excited. And I've written these other two songs, three songs, Crystal Gale, and I can't wait to hear her vocal. And I know y'all have heard Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue by Crystal Gale. And she's such a wonderful vocalist. So she's one of my top five female vocalists. So I'm so excited about her. And then Mickey Gilley. I just did a painting of Jerry Lee Lewis. And he's looking back at his 12-year-old self. And he's on fire with a piano, and he's looking back at his little 12-year-old self with the overalls on back in the 40s. And he's playing this real old piano, and it's called Looking Back at Me. So I wrote this song, Looking Back at Me, and I called Mickey, and I played it for Mickey Gilley, and he goes, I'm 84, Ronnie. I'm not in too good a shape, but come Monday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm going to sing on this with you. And I said, well, Jerry, I said, Mickey, you are Jerry Lee Lewis's first cousin. And we're going to surprise Jerry Lee Lewis with this duet, these two that he probably doesn't remember, Heartaches by the Number, doing that. And then I want to unveil this new painting, Looking Back at Me. So that's what I'm doing as soon as the smoke clears. Now, Tyler and I, we did a painting. Now, my ultimate country icon, I'm being redundant, is Hank Sr. That's the first thing I ever sang in my life was, You're Cheating Heart, when I was four. I was walking around the house singing, You're Cheating Heart. Well, Hank Sr. hung out at Tootsie's Orchid Lounge. Y'all probably don't know that. You know where Tootsie's is on Broadway and Nashville?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. It's the iconic club of all time on Broadway. Yeah. And so Hank Sr. in 1951, 52, 53, he would go in. It was called Mom's Place then. He would go in there and get a fifth of Jack Daniels and just get wasted. But nobody would bother him. So I painted Hank Sr. coming out of Tootsie's. And in the background is Kid Rock.
Because, oh, I've seen this. Yes, yes.
Well, Kid Rock's icon is Hank Sr. Yeah. So I'm pulling out of the subdivision after we finished it, Tyler called me and he goes, Dad, Kid Rock wants us over to the country club right now. I said, really? So when we got over there, you know, he was crying.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, he texted me last week and he said, when the smoke clears, I want you and your son to come and have dinner with me. And I'm going to show you the prominent place that I hung this painting. You'll never know what this means to me. Mm. So, you know, when we do these paintings, some of them that I did one for Steve Jeppy, his mama, his brother who passed away, and his mom and his sister and him. And I had his 36-year-old mama sitting in a chair. It's a metaphor, you know, and they're all grown standing behind her. And I told him, I said, Steve, I'm sending you a little something for you for Mother's Day. And so last Sunday, he got it. It's huge. It's 36 by 42. Mm. But it looks, and his mother is so beautiful sitting in that chair. He called me crying too. He said, this is the greatest gift I've ever been given.
Oh, that's
cool. So when we do these paintings, I didn't realize, I do now, how they affect people. And I said, well, Steve, you've got Walt Disney's original Mickey Mouse drawings. He said, it doesn't matter. This is my greatest gift. Cool.
Yeah. Wow.
So if I'm talking too much, boys, just tell me.
No, you're not.
I'm not giving y'all a chance to say anything.
No, you're fine. We're still live on YouTube. So if anybody watching, we're probably a little behind on there. Anybody watching that has any questions for Ronnie, let us know. We'll let him know, see if he wants to answer them or not. So you've painted pictures for Disney. Tyler is a huge Disney World, Disneyland fan. Do you have the same level of love for the parks as he does? Do you like going to the parks with Tyler, or how does that?
Tyler and I, we have a ball when we go to the parks. I'm not, as much into it as he is.
Yeah, yeah.
But I still love it. I was there opening day for Epcot Center.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so that was in the 80s, early 80s. But I wanted to be there, and, at that time, I think I was 31, 32. I was on the road with my friend Conway Twitty, and I had a weekend off, so I wanted to go. And I never will forget sitting on the monorail, two seats in front of me was John Wayne's son.
Oh, wow.
Patrick Wayne and Dawn Wells of Gilligan's Island.
That's awesome.
Wow. And she still looked just like that then. And then we were on Ralph Emery with her, the Ralph Emery show, and she was a guest on there with me. And I said, I saw you in 1981 or 82 with Patrick Wayne, John Wayne's son. And so I had a song out called In a New York Minute, and I went to Arizona and I was performing it, and it was a top five record at the time. And Patrick Wayne was there, and he come up to the stage. He said, hey, Ronnie, play that In a New York Minute song. And he said, and come over there and talk to me after I get through. And I'm big John Wayne nut, so I couldn't believe I was getting to talk to John Wayne's son. Really nice guy.
That's cool. Now, you were also at the opening of Disney's MGM Hollywood Studios? You did the handprints. You did all that fun stuff?
I did, yeah. And there's a picture. I told Tyler this today when I was putting my hands in the cement, which was a big honor, by the way.
Yeah.
And Mickey Mouse standing behind me. And Tyler is like, I think he's 3 or 4 or 6, but he's looking up at Daddy. I like, wow, Daddy's getting to do this. I look at that picture all the time because he was just cool. In awe, Of course, it meant a lot to me, but can you imagine what it meant to him?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's cool. Well, I think we got a couple questions coming in.
Sure.
Melissa Randall asked, Ronnie, what's been your favorite venue to play at?
Wow, that's a loaded question. I mean, so many. There's a place that I love in Bell Buckle, Tennessee. It's the prettiest little town. It looks like a postcard. There's a railroad going through it. It's kind of like my hometown of Portland, but they have taken this and they've left everything just like it was in the 30s and the 40s. And the little town, I swear, if you ever get a chance to go to Bell Buckle, Tennessee, and the venue there is so beautiful. They have weddings, and they've just made it look beautiful, and I love coming there. The restaurant there is unbelievable, but it's home cooking, but that's what I grew up with.
Yeah.
Eating beans and potatoes, and of course, we couldn't afford meat, and cornbread. And slaw, and that was pretty much our diet. But I didn't realize it at the time, but we were getting the proper amount of starch, the proper amount of protein with the beans. So the food was wonderful. And can you believe to this day, that's my favorite food. I used to eat bologna because that's all we could afford, but I don't eat that stuff anymore. Because my best friend used to work at Oscar Mayer, and he told me what was in it. And he said, whatever you do. Do not eat bologna and hot dogs the rest of your life.
Don't tell my son.
It is hard to eat a meat that has a first name. That's always been fun.
Isn't that the truth?
There's nothing better than hot, cornbread fresh out of the oven.
Oh, nothing.
Now Southern cornbread, the good.
Oh yeah,
the good.
In a black skillet.
Oh now, yeah,
black skillet cornbread. And my sister, all of my sisters, they make it like my mother. There is nothing in the world like that. If a restaurant would serve that, you would not be able to keep people out of there. And fried corn, the way my mother used to do it. I mean, the stuff that, you know, I grew up with and I still love it. As a matter of fact, I got me some corn down in the fridge. I got it Kroger today, and I'm going to fix me some tonight. Yeah. I'm a corn nut.
Yeah, we grew up on that good, I mean, being from Tennessee, that good Southern cooking that our grandmother would make. And oh, there's nothing.
Everything had a stick of butter in it.
Corn did. Or lard.
Yeah. She lived in her late 90s. So, I mean, that's what she ate all her life. So, it must be good for you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, I never will forget. Every time Mother would fry up potatoes, she'd take a big old scoop of that out of that big old lard can and plop that stuff in there. But, boy, nothing tasted like it.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't eat that stuff today, you know, for nothing. But you talk, that's heart attack on a plate.
Just makes you stronger. That's not us.
So Micah was one of our was our guest last week. Micah, he has a YouTube channel. He's one of your biggest fans. He's got a question. He goes, "What is your favorite memory of Tyler? You got any fun Tyler stories you could tell us?"
Well, I have all kind of memories of Tyler.
Make sure it's embarrassing.
I've got memories of all of my kids. Some of the funniest things they would do and say. And, I mean, but most of them I can't tell you, but. Tyler, believe it or not, I never will forget this as long as I live. Tyler was signed to Curb Records when he was 7 or 8 or 9. And I took him to Mike. I recorded a couple of songs with him that I had written. And Mike Curb's daughter saw his 8x10s and heard his 2 songs. And Mike Curb called me. So Tyler went down to meet all of these, you know, executives and everything. And here's what he would do. He did this. I didn't tell him to do it. He jumped up on that table with all those executives and just walked back and forth performing for all the executives and singing. And he would do, "Swanee, how I love you, how I love you, my dear old Swanee." And he's the only kid in the world that knows who Al Jolson is, but he would do that. He's the only kid that would, and Mike Curb walked up to me, and this is what Mike Curb said. He said, "There is no way that Donny Osmond could have done what he did." I said, "Mike, I didn't tell him to do that. He just likes performing for people." And he still does.
Yeah. He wanted me to ask you about your experience on, Flight of Passage, the Avatar ride, and the new Star Wars ride.
I will tell you this. The Avatar thing, I told Tyler, I said, when we had to wait in line for 2 hours. But when I got on that and we did that, that was the most unbelievable thing I've ever experienced in my life. I've told everybody that. It's worth the 2-hour wait. And then we did the Star Wars thing. And I was like, my goodness, I thought the Avatar thing was something. I mean, have y'all done it? Have you been?
I have, yeah.
Oh,
Ryan has.
It is mind-boggling what they do and what they've come up with.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's you know, when I rode the Flight of Passage, the Avatar one, that was, I rode it before the Star Wars one was open. And when I rode that, I was like, it was like, you know, like an out-of-body experience. You just... You're like in a different world, and then you forget that you're on a ride. And then when I rode the Star Wars one, it was just like, man, it's like you're in the Star Wars movies.
It's like you were in a movie, I agree. Yeah. Yeah. So they've taken it to a place that I would have never have dreamed when I went to the first day at Epcot.
Yeah.
You know, and you rode up through the earth, you know, and you saw all the things. Well, wow, look where they've taken it from there.
I know.
It's unbelievable.
It's amazing. It's creativity in people.
Just like Tyler. I mean, Tyler to me is as creative as any Disney engineer. And I'm not just saying it because he's my son and my kid. He is. He has that type of creativity. It's just, it boggles my brain.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder if he really is mine, but then I look at him and I go, yeah, he's mine.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. You can definitely tell. Yeah.
But my dad was like that. My dad was a master carpenter. I could show you two stagecoaches right now that my dad made. He made a stagecoach and a covered wagon when he was 15. I have them downstairs. Wow. Oh, and wow. He was only 15 when he was a Boy Scout. That was 1925. So 95 years ago. Isn't that amazing?
That's crazy.
So that's where Tyler gets that, you know. Dad was just, daddy was something else too. I guess we all get it from that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Not so much a question, but Melissa Randall says, Ronnie, you are our Elvis and Conway. We love you and thank you for making each of us feel so special at your shows.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? And I love Melissa. She's the sweetest girl. She had a mask the other day, but it was one of my bandanas with my name on it. And that's what she wears for a mask. But Melissa, she's been coming to see me for 43 years, ever since she was a little girl.
Oh, wow.
She's still a little girl.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, guys, do you have any, Catron, Chris, do you have any other questions or? You've been awful quiet.
I've just
probably because I've been running my mouth.
No, I've been loving to listen to it. I guess I could ask because like I'm more of like a comic book geek. I mean, I like my brother had said, I've worked in films and stuff like that. I love superheroes, and Tyler did mention that you're a big Superman fan.
Oh yeah,
as well that you like Superman because I grew up on Superman. Like that was like. Started my comic book collection with Superman. Like I came in like with the death of Superman when all that was happening and stuff like that. So, and I watched the old black and white show and
George Reeves.
Yes. With George Reeves. And like that was on our Nick at Night.
Oh yeah.
So I love that. But yeah, I didn't know if you had any like stories with that. Like, I mean, did you like read comic books as a kid or just like, did you kind of get into that
I did. But you know, when we would have snow days, they would play the old George Reeves Superman shows. And of course me and my buddies, they would play that and the old Johnny Weissmuller Tarzan movies. And boy, we were in hog heaven when they played Superman and, and the Tarzan movies. So, oh yeah. And we all grew up reading comics, but I never dreamed that I would, again, be my brother, Steve Jeppy. I know, you know who Steve Jeppy is, the CEO of Diamond Comics. And he said that they're going to kick back the comic, world, the 20th of May, it's going to open back up. So people, so they'll be able to get the comics again. So, Steve, again, is the world's biggest Elvis fan besides me. And, you know, he knows everything about every comic book hero and everything about comics. That's his world.
Oh, yeah. I even heard that. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I even heard that Tyler mentioned that you even watched Smallville.
I got so engrossed in that I would wait till the whole season was over. And I watched that over and over and over. I just, because Superman, you know, when I was a kid, like I say, we love Superman, but I got so engrossed in that Smallville and I couldn't understand why they didn't use that boy as Superman in the movie that came out.
Oh,
instead
yeah.
of that, the guy, I can't think of his name, Brandon Routh. Yeah. I thought they would have used the guy that was in Smallville, but I guess, you know, they tried doing different things. But that guy did a good job, too. He did good.
Oh,
job. Did you like Steve Reeves? Did you like him as Superman? Not Steve Reeves.
Christopher Reeves.
The other Reeves.
Christopher Reeves. Yeah. I liked it. Like, I grew up watching...
That's my Superman, yeah. Christopher Reeve. That's what I grew up on.
Yeah.
I can't think of his name on Smallville. I think Tom Welling. He was a great Clark Kent. He never quite made it to Superman for me, but that wasn't the story. It was about Clark Kent, really. And right. I did a great job. Brandon Routh, I thought, did a good job, but it was definitely the same world as Christopher Reeves. Like, it was like almost like a love note to those movies. So I think it did a really good job. But yeah, I did like Christopher Reeves a lot. He was growing up, that was like the first real kind of Superman for me. Like, I watched the old show, but that one just, the effects and everything, him actually flying, just looked great. Oh, yeah. And I mean, those type of movies and stuff like that, that's what really kind of got me into like film and making movies and stuff like that. So it's awesome.
Oh, that's cool. I get it.
Our dad is actually watching right now, and he's on the talk. He said, Ronnie, anytime you want some good cornbread, to come on up to East Tennessee, John City, and make it so. He's an author, and he actually wrote this book called Elvis: Fast Cars and the Brown Mountain Lights.
Oh wow!
So he's wrote a bunch of bunch of books about East Tennessee and that area, and this one. It has something to do with Elvis in the background of it, but it's mostly about some moonshine runners and stuff up in the Brown Mountains, and there's some love for Elvis in there too. But
You tell your dad, he's probably familiar with this. That not to interrupt, but you know, Elvis was on his way to New York to do the Milton Berle show.
Yeah,
and he played there in Bristol. That was the last place, and that building is still there. And, you know, I love history, stuff like that. And I love to know that these places are still there. In 1956, when Elvis went to play the Frontier in Las Vegas, he bombed. He's supposed to be there 2 weeks. But those people were used to seeing the 40s acts. They didn't want to see a 21 or 19, 20-year-old guy, you know, swiveling his hips and rock and roll. And he bombed, but one day by the swimming pool. A jeweler from Memphis came up, and it was Scotty and DJ and Bill Black and Elvis. And he said, Elvis, I have made you a watch. So Elvis took his 1956 Elgin off that he wore on the Milton Berle show and his early TV shows. And he goes, any of you boys need a watch? And Scotty goes, yeah, I do. So he handed it to Scotty. Scotty took it home and put it in a drawer. And on my 44th birthday, Scotty came with DJ to my birthday party. And Scotty said, me and DJ want to give you a present. He took that watch that was in that drawer for 40-something years, had it reworked, and gave it to me. And when we did that Pawn Star show, well, the guy knew that I had that watch. And he said, I understand you got Elvis's watch that he wore on the Milton Berle show. And I said, I do. Scotty gave it to me. And with a plaque saying the story of the watch, I still have that. And so he said, I'd like to buy that watch. And I said, well, you know, Scotty gave it to me. And I said, it's been in my drawer for 10 years now. He said, well, it ain't doing no good in your drawer. And I said, well, let me call Scotty. And I said, Scotty, the guy on that Pawn Star show we just did, he wants to buy that watch. He said, what does he want to give you for it? I said, 25 grand. He said, well, good God, Ronnie, you only give $100 for it. Sell it to him. So I sold him the watch. And I want you to know it sold the other day in Australia to a guy for $160,000.
Oh, wow. Oh, God.
But when I was 54, 25 grand was a lot of money.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of money for me.
Yeah. Hey, I'm an old poor boy from Portland. Trust me.
Yeah.
A lot of money.
I have a question. So what's do you have a favorite song that you perform that you like to sing? Maybe just sing, not necessarily perform, but is there something that you just love singing?
I do. I can answer that just real quick. In 1987, y'all may not know this, but my band was the Kentucky Headhunters. Do you remember them?
Oh, yeah.
Dumas Walker. Well, they were my band for 8 years. So I'm driving down the road in that same Camaro. This was 10 years later. I still had it. So all of a sudden, this came in my brain, you know. But it's only make-believe. And I went, wow, an up-tempo version of Conway's song. We recorded it, me and the Headhunters. I found Conway in a studio I said, Conway, would you play this? I'd already been working with him 7 years opening up his shows. He said, and here's the way he talked. He goes, what is it? I said, well, it's only make-believe. And he goes, now, why would I want to listen to that? I said, well, because I did it different. He listened to it. He jumped up out of his chair and he goes, that's a monster. Put that out. That's a hit. And I said, but Conway, you got to sing on it with me. He said, you don't need me on that. That's a hit without me. I said, Conway, you got to sing on this. Think about this. If I go, take it, Conway, I said, it'll give people chills when you come in. Well, I talked him into it. And when it got in the top five, if I'm lying, I'm dying. My phone rang. And he goes, Ronnie, this is Conway. Like I didn't know who it was. Right? I said, yes, sir. And he said, son, I've been thinking about it, and you did need me on that. And I kept waiting for him to laugh. He was dead serious. But that's just the way he was.
That's cool.
And I miss Conway. I think about him. I went to his grave the other day, and I stood there, and I looked down, and I said, Conway, thank you for believing in me. Because he walked up to me on my 29th birthday spinning a 45 record, 1979. He goes, you know what this is? I said, yes, sir, it's a record. And he goes, it's a hit song. The guy that put it out originally, it didn't work for him. You take it home and listen to it, and if you like it, it's yours. I brought it back the next day, and I said, Conway, I don't really care for that. And he said, then I'm going to do it. Number one record, Happy Birthday, Dog.
Oh, wow.
So not long after that, he called me on his bus in Louisville. We were at the Louisville Gardens, two sold-out shows. That guy was the hottest thing in the business. And he said, son, you've turned down a number one record. I found you another one. I said, what is it? He said, well, I'm going to sing it for you. It was just me and him on the bus. And he said, now, it's about a man and his wife. I said, well, that's fine. Let me hear it. He goes, there's a lot of ways of saying what I want to say to you. And there's songs and poems and promises and dreams that might come true. But I won't speak of starry skies, moonlight on the ground. I'll come right out and tell you, I'd just love to lay you down. And he was looking at me right in the eye. Now, I'm all boy. And that made me really uncomfortable. And I said, Conway, you've got to be kidding me. Who is going to play a song called I'd Love to Lay You Down? Huge number one record for Conway Twitty.
Yeah, that's great.
So that ain't the end of that story. So I was at Center Point Barbecue, which is still there. That was his favorite place to eat. I jumped out of my old Ford pickup truck. Here comes Conway spinning gravel. Honey, I should run into you tonight. I said, why is that? And he said, I got a song for you. I said, give me that sucker. I don't care what it sounds like. And I told that at Conway's funeral service because it's the truth.
Yeah.
And one day I asked him, I said, Conway, why are you always trying to give me these songs? He goes, because I believe in you. That's why. Mm-hmm. So that's why I go to his grave periodically. Yeah. And I say that to him every time.
Wow.
I miss him.
Yeah.
Yep.
Awesome.
So again, have I been blessed?
You have been blessed. Greatly. Oh, man.
And I'm blessed to be here with you boys on this, and I really appreciate you having me on here.
Well, thank you for coming on. We've been blessed to have you on, and thank you, Tyler, for hooking all this up for us and getting you going. Has this been your first podcast, or have you been on other podcasts?
Well, you know, I guess it's my first podcast, so to speak, you know, but you know, I just been doing this kind of stuff,
yeah,
so many years, you know. But I enjoy it. As a matter of fact, Tyler and I are getting ready to do a audio version of my book, and I'm literally going to read my book, bringing it to you,
cool,
personally, and so that we can have CDs of my book, because the author thinks that that will resell since I'm reading the book myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's and the book is like I'm talking anyway, and it's my life and my,
that's cool,
you know, and it's a very positive book. I told the author, he came up to me and said, Scott England said, I want to do a book about your life. It was a few years ago. And I said, Scott, I'm not old enough for that. And he goes, yes, you are. And so, I said, well, why do you want to do a book about me? He said, when I was 14, there was a girl that came to see you. She was 14. We met. We've been married 37 years and we met at your show. But that's not why I want to do a book about your life. He pulled out a black and white 8x10. He said, you remember this boy? And I looked at it and I said, I sure do. He said, well, he used to come to see you all the time, Ronnie. He became a famous magician. But on his 25th birthday, he was dying of leukemia. And on his deathbed, he called me over and whispered in my ear. And he said, go see Ronnie. And I said, okay, we'll do it. And that's the truth. I said, again, but it's got to be all positive. I don't want nothing negative about nobody or anything. And that's what we did. We made it positive. There's enough negativity. Yeah. And, you know, I just didn't want to, you know, use four-letter words in it. And then the next book he did was my buddy Johnny Lee. And he came, Scott came to see me, and he said, well, let me tell you what. Your book and his is like night and day. He said, I've never heard so much cussing in my life. And he wanted it in the book. I said, well, that's my buddy Johnny. You got to roll with the flow with him. But anyway, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And thank you all for loving my son. He's a good boy. Thank
he
you.
Is a good boy.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
And he's, shaking his head. No, I'm not.
Oh, yes, he is. So our dad, Gary, he's been watching. He said that he's going to send you one of these books.
Tell him I would appreciate that more than he ever knows, because I love to read. I love to, and I love the fact that he likes Elvis.
Yeah, he's going to send you one. So I'll get the information from Tyler when we get off here, and it'll be coming to you. And hopefully, you know, I pray that the world will get back to normal, get you back out on the road.
Yeah, me too. Hey,
travel.
You know, this is such a sad thing for me, because it not only affects me, it affects every business. If you think about it, you know, I got to thinking, well, my business is hands-on people, right?
Yeah.
I mean, literally. Well, if you think about it, every business is. Every business has to have people, whether it's casinos, churches, banks, it doesn't matter. So we're all in this together.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been, you know, Tyler and I, we've kind of followed the guidelines and the rules. I go out and I do things, and I get out and do things in the fresh air and do, but you know, I stay away from people and I don't get close to people, but, hopefully my immune system, kicks, you know what, and I won't deal with any of that stuff, but I feel sad for all the folks that have.
Yeah.
And I hope anybody that has it, I hope they recover fast and soon. And I hope everybody kind of, can get back to their lives, you know, and this stuff will, they'll find a vaccine for it. That's what I hope and pray.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for coming on. It's been a true pleasure. And you're welcome on anytime. Anytime you want to tell some stories, you can come on. I Am Geek.
Well, I'm like Jimmy Durante. I got a million of them.
Yeah.
But thank you all for listening to me. And again, I hope I didn't talk your ears off. You know, I just love doing what I do. I've been up. I've learned how I was when I was a kid. I was the shyest kid that ever lived. And that's the truth. I wouldn't sing in front of anybody. But when I got, I'm going to tell y'all what happened. In Vietnam, we had took a break from fighting. We had a variety show. And me and Chuck Nitsche and Joe Hedgepeth, this was 1968. So you can tell I'm not getting dementia, that I still remember Chuck Nitsche and Joe Hedgepeth. So we decided we were going to enter the contest. We did. You're not going to believe this, but this old man grabbed my arm just for a step on stage. And he goes, son, right where you're going to sing, Elvis Presley stood right there in 1956 on the Milton Berle show. And I looked at him and I went, yeah, right. Well, come to find out, that was the truth. The first time I ever sang in front of anybody was right where Elvis stood. Again, irony. It is so crazy about, you know, I became Elvis's voice in these movies and TV shows and a Twilight Zone episode. And so I found out that Elvis actually stood there on the Milton Berle show. And then my daughter called me not long ago and she goes, hey, Dad, do you know who Elvis's grandfather is? And I said, well, yeah, I know everything about Elvis. She goes, no, you don't. I said, well, who is it? She said, well, just Google Elvis Presley's grandfather. So I did, and it's Jesse D. McDowell.
Huh. How about that?
Wow. Now, isn't that weird? I mean, you can Google it on your phone. And well, I'm not going to tell you why it is, but anyway, but it's kind of cool that his grand, that's Vernon's father, Jesse D. McDowell.
Wow.
So
that's awesome.
There's an unbelievable connection there. And I'm not saying I'm kin to Elvis. Everybody won't say kin to Elvis, you know. But of all the names in the world, it's Jesse D. McDowell.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think that's pretty
cool. That is cool. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'd say spiritually, you are connected to your
kid. Yeah, and it wasn't meant for me to get in that HCL, you know? It wasn't. Like Steve said, it wasn't meant for me to do that. Nope.
Yeah. Now, when does your new album come out, or is it out?
Well, as soon as the smoke clears, Mickey Gilley's doing his vocal tomorrow. Crystal Gayle's already done hers. I've got to put my vocal on both of these songs. So it's going to be hopefully in June.
Oh, cool.
The single and the album.
Oh, cool.
But me and Wayne Newton are doing Saturday Night Special. Now, isn't that
cool? Look at that.
Me and Jack Scott, who just passed away, we did Burning Bridges. Jack Scott, huge 50s artist. There's 20 duets. Me and the Oak Ridge Boys, we're doing a song that me and Mike Kerr wrote called Make America Great Again. I wonder where that came from. And I'm not even into politics. I hate politics. But I love the song. I love the song that me and the Oak Ridge Boys did.
That's cool.
Wow. And so many artists on this album. I love the duet with Dolly. I forget who all's on the album. Just me and Bobby Vintner doing Blue Velvet. You remember Bobby? Yeah. So I love the whole album. I just, because I got to sing with all these iconic people.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's awesome. Cool. Well, thank you again for joining us. We know you're a busy man. You got a lot of things to do, so we don't want to keep you on.
Well, the only thing I'm doing is y'all have made me hungry talking about cornbread.
there we go.
So trust me, I'm going to make me some cornbread.
Dude, there we go.
And I hope y'all have a wonderful night and stay safe.
Thank you. You too. Stay safe. Be good. Thank you to all our listeners and watchers. And this has been I Am Geek episode 146. And we'll be talking with you next week.